Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Welcome back to The Brian Lehrer Show. I'm Jamil Smith, in for Brian. Next, we go to Harvard University, where fraternity culture may be about to die. A faculty committee just released a 22-page report recommending that the university cut off membership to frats, sororities, and similar organizations starting in the fall of next year. Any incoming freshman in the class of 2022 would be banned from joining any of those organizations, including the university's prestigious and controversial final clubs, which traditionally only invite men to join. The faculty's argument? These groups are a petri dish for sexism, emotional and alcohol abuse, and elitism. The report read in part, quote, "Time after time, the social organizations have demonstrated behavior inconsistent with an inclusive campus culture, a disregard for the personhood and safety of fellow students, and an unwillingness to change, even as new students join them over generations." Joining me now is civil rights attorney Alexandra Brodsky. She's a Skadden Fellow at the National Women's Law Center, where she works on education equity and student discipline. She's also the co-founder of the organization Know Your Nine. Alexandra, welcome to WNYC.
Thanks for having me, Jamil.
So what is your opinion on this Harvard proposal, and do you think fraternity and sorority life is somehow exclusionary or elitist?
I'm going to be honest, it's really tough, and I've been going back and forth on this. I am automatically skeptical of sex-segregated spaces. I think that they end up relying on and perpetuating a lot of really harmful stereotypes. And I've also heard from some young alumni of Harvard that these institutions, even when they are sex-segregated, are too often racist and classist. But, you know, I have to be honest that sometimes I worry that when a university is so far ahead of its student body on a question like this, that there will be resistance, that there will be an underground. And the last thing that I want is for a bunch of wealthy white dudes to feel like they're being edgy by hanging out with other wealthy white dudes in some kind of underground social scene.
Right. Well, let's also consider the fact that, you know, you're banning not just white fraternities, but you're also banning, in this, you know, in this proposal, black fraternities, fraternities from other cultures. How does that dynamic differ, you know, say, you know, with, you know, black Greek life, Asian Greek life to white Greek life?
Yeah, you know, I think that that's an important distinction, because for many of these organizations, like, as I understand, the final clubs, you know, these are really sort of petri dishes of privilege that serve to push out and exclude the rest of the campus. But we, you know, there are also many students who don't feel welcome in the mainstream culture of the campus, who feel like they are not welcome, and historically that's been true. And to have, you know, their own spaces can be really powerful. That was certainly my experience as an undergrad with an off-campus organization that made me feel like I had a space at my school. What's tricky is that, you know, that is hard for a university it's hard for a university to draw those lines, right? We can imagine both the legal and the media outcry if they said, you know, no all men organizations, but you can have all women, you know, no historically white fraternities, but you can have historically black fraternities.
Well, in that light, though, you have the fact that this, you know, Harvard has really targeted the male-only final clubs with this new policy last year, banning, in effect, you know, any new students who, you know, from joining, who join unrecognized single-gender social organizations from holding leadership positions in recognized student organizations or sports teams. So that punishes women in sororities, too, as does this new recommendation. Do you have any thoughts as to how universities can best address that gender dynamic, you know, address the problems in fraternity life without diminishing or ending sorority life?
It's really tough. And I think that part of what makes it tough is that I know students who have found the gender policing of sororities to also be very damaging, who felt, you know, students who didn't, you know, women who didn't fit gender stereotypes and felt unwelcome in sorority spaces, or gender nonconforming students who felt like there wasn't a place in the binary of fraternities and sororities for them. Again, that being said, and this, you know, goes back to your earlier point, you know, university, you know, co-education is pretty new at schools like Harvard. It's just a couple of decades old, and universities have done a pretty bad job of welcoming women to their campuses in the years since. And it is unsurprising to me that as a result, students, you know, women will seek out all women spaces. What I would hope is that the university would do the hard work of making sure that women and gender minorities can feel comfortable throughout the campus, rather than relying on, again, very binary systems that can serve to reinforce narrow ideas of what it means to be a good woman.
Right. Listeners, my guest is Alexandra Brodsky of Know Your Nine. What are your opinions on fraternity culture and colleges today and this Harvard report recommending the end of all fraternities, sororities, and final clubs? The number to call is 212-433-WNYC. Again, that's 212-433-9692. Do you think an idea like Harvard's helps or hurts? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Alexandra, I want to ask you, considering the epidemic of sexual assault and harassment on America's college campuses, does banning fraternities help solve the problem? And if so, why do sororities have to go too?
Sure. Causation here is so difficult. I think there's been some really powerful research about the violence and just terrible decision-making that comes out of all male spaces where the members prove their masculinity to each other by denigrating women. It is unsurprising to me that these dens of toxic masculinity often promote sexual assault and other forms of violence.
Mm-hmm.
That being said, obviously campus rape isn't limited to fraternities. I wish that were the case. We would have a much easier fight in front of us if that were the case. And, you know, we know that those, the ideology that promotes violence or excuses violence might be particularly fervent in some fraternities, but lives throughout the rest of campus as well.
Mm-hmm.
And we also know that there are men who are doing really great work, including in fraternities, to promote healthier ideas of masculinity that aren't premised on hurting women.
Well,
the tricky thing is, even if we decide that these men-only spaces are just too much of a risk, I'm not sure, and this is not my official legal opinion, but I'm not sure legally how a school could get around banning fraternities without banning sororities.
Right. I want to go to the callers. Catherine in Scarsdale, welcome to WNYC.
Hi. So my daughter graduated in 2016 from Rice University, and I think it would be a great model to look at. They have a very well-established residential college system. So as a freshman, you are randomly assigned one of, I think, 11 or 12 residential colleges, and you live there for your 4 years. If you choose to live on campus all 4 years, you eat there, and the residential colleges are inclusionary. Freshman through senior year, male and female, they host parties, social events, athletic events, etc. And I think it's a really great way of including everybody without needing sororities or fraternities or other exclusionary organizations on campus for social integration, etc.
Right. Thank you. Thank you, Catherine, for the call. Alexandra, do we need just different models? Instead of banning fraternities, we just need maybe universities to embrace different models for socialization, frankly.
Yeah, I love the idea of bringing the Centers for Campus Social Life back into the university proper. I remember mm-hmm. one of my law professors who went to my undergrad saying that she felt that she wished the school would return to its old model back when the drinking age was 18 of having the keggers in the dining hall. Because what that meant was that that social space was inclusive, it was open to everyone, and alcohol prohibitions didn't push students off campus into their own segregated spaces. Mm-hmm. And, you know, again, I think that that's a way that universities, I understand that the laws are a little bit different now around alcohol, but they can take affirmative steps to create inclusive social spaces on campus rather than just depriving students of options off campus.
Right. This is the Brian Lehrer Show. I'm Jamil Smith in for Brian, and I'm talking with civil rights attorney Alexandra Brodsky about a proposal to do away with Greek life at Harvard University and all the ways that might affect campus life. I want to go back to the calls. I want to talk to Michael in Somerset, New Jersey. Welcome, Michael.
Hey, how are you?
Hey, how you doing?
Can you hear me okay?
Yep.
Yeah. So, this is an issue that I have some history with and did, some research on. I was involved in the fraternities in the 1980s, leading the fraternity council there, and I worked as an advisor to fraternities in a college when I was in graduate school, and did some research in graduate school when I was studying higher ed administration. And I struggled with it even when I was in college, working to try and influence the culture of fraternities from the inside, including a move to abandon pledging. We were successful in eliminating pledging in the first semester, so that pledges could really kind of assess the scene and the different organizations before kind of being roped in through drinking during rush week, that kind of thing.
Right.
I definitely, in terms of the question of whether or not to ban them, I don't know if you can wholly ban them as private organizations, but you can certainly stop supporting them and take all kinds of measures to, kind of curtail their growth. Rutgers has done a lot, to kind of take control and influence, the fraternity system over time. But, these all-male groups, absolutely. You have kids that are 18 to 22 making a lot of bad decisions. As your speaker said, moving alcohol, kind of underground. And whereas in the, prior to that, you had the ability to really kind of create inclusive spaces and monitor them and that kind of thing. A lot of bad things can happen, and the alumni of these organizations, in my experience, you have the formal leadership of alumni that, kind of may say certain things and even promote certain things, but the alumni culture is not much different, and it's very hard to change the culture of organizations that turn over in just a few years of leadership. So you have a new brood coming in with the same kind of preconceived notions of what Greek life is. And so although there are fraternities, or organizations even that, I remember Gamma Sig at Rutgers was a co-ed fraternity,
right?
Or whatever you call it.
Yeah.
I almost wish I was there, they were right next door to us, good friends.
Yeah.
So anyway, I got a lot of thoughts on that, just the way, hazing and all these things and how they developed over time.
Right.
It's pretty interesting stuff.
Thank you for the call, Michael. I can confess I was actually in a co-ed fraternity when I was a student in college. And, there was, a pledging process, but there was no hazing. There was, certainly no physical abuse or emotional abuse, or certainly no abuse of alcohol. Is co-ed fraternity, life maybe a way out of this, Alexandra?
Yeah, I was in a co-ed fraternity in college as well, and I loved it. I think that we sort of took an active effort to reject the worst of Greek life. With that being said, it was still exclusive, right? We were still drawing a line between ourselves and the rest of the community. And I understand why that might not be good for student life overall. With that being said, I think that having, you know, students having experiences with intentional communities that, right, aren't based on sex segregation, that aren't based on, you know, extreme alcohol abuse, can be a really important, affirming experience for a young person, and it certainly was for me.
I want to go to Emily in Montclair, New Jersey. Welcome to WNYC.
Hi. So a lot of interesting conversation. I teach at a college here in New Jersey, and I'm also the director of our very small women's studies minor program. So I have some thoughts on it from the gender perspective, and also thinking about from a social psych perspective about how people do like having organizations they belong to. People enjoy that feeling of, you know, connection, and a lot of people talk about things they get from being in a group they have an identity with. So I do think Harvard's taking a bold stance because I fundamentally agree with all the general critiques of it, the gender critiques, the elitism critiques, et cetera. So my inclination is, you know, good, Harvard, you're really taking a bold stance and there are real issues here. But like the speaker before, I'm aware of how difficult it is to challenge this big, you know, big system. And so I think a lot of education is needed around the country and at campuses about what are some of the problems, because it's not so obvious to everyone immediately, and so our Harvard stance seems so strange and radical to people who sort of feel innocently, oh, I just like my club and I make friends there, et cetera. So I'll just throw out just one thing that when I learned this, it impacted me, which I think people should know about. Mm-hmm. And that is, I learned this through Michael Kimmel, who's an eminent sociologist of gender at Stony Brook. And he has his recent book talks, one of the things he talks about is the fraternity culture around hazing, and he talks about how homophobic it is and how sexist it is, et cetera. But one of the things he mentions is that by national charter, fraternity houses are allowed to have alcohol at their parties, and sororities are not. And if you just think about that one fact, it creates a situation where people, the parties are going to be at the fraternity houses usually, and it's in the male space, they control the drinking, and all sorts of negative things that we all know come out of that process of picking the type of women who you let in, and then the drinking, and who controls the drinking, and the women have to keep up with the male drinking to be cool because it's the guy thing, and you want to show you're one of the guys, or you fit in, and then all the issues on rape, etc.
Right.
So that's just one example that just structurally in their basic setup, there's a real problem with fraternities and sororities and that level. And there's many more things that, you know, one could go into, but I would just say that there needs to be a really fuller, more deep exploration of what about it, about the way it's gendered, is so problematic and causes all sorts of problems. Because, you know, we could go on about that, but I hear when people feel defensive about their fraternities and sororities, they don't see that, some of those problems. They haven't really thought those through.
Mm-hmm.
And I think colleges need to do that. And then we have to acknowledge that need for connection and belonging and create alternative ways to do that. And in terms of women, students of color, who often do need safe spaces or comfortable spaces or spaces to bond with other people they can relate to and support them, especially if they're in an environment which is very elitist and it's not what they're comfortable or familiar with, that's another thing universities need to take on. It's a legitimate need, and people need to, you know, be encouraged to do that. You know, there can be dorms that are built around themes, around issues that people care about. There can be clubs based around ethnicity, race, gender, etc. So there are things like that can be done.
Right.
But I just want to put out that it's a lot of education that can be needed to really tackle this question. But good for Harvard for trying to take it on.
Appreciate that, Emily. Thank you very much. Sarah in New Brunswick, New Jersey. Welcome to WNYC.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I was in a sorority in college. I was president of my sorority. And I have to say that if I had gone to another school, I probably wouldn't have joined Greek life. I think a lot of Greek life has to do with how we deal with it and how we perpetuate the environment and stereotypes. I went to a small school outside of the city in New Jersey, and I would say that we were very diverse. We were forced to work together. Community standards were enforced most of the time, and it wasn't perfect, but we learned how to work with other organizations and people of other backgrounds, and that was very encouraging. But I think it's really contingent on, you know, how we enforce that and the attitudes. If you have this inclusivity problem at, you know, a very prestigious university where you're talking about a lot of excluding people because based on race or gender, then we're going to perpetuate these problems with hazing, with attitude, and that's not good.
Right. Alexandra, do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think that that's 100% true, that the environment of the school writ large is going to inform its Greek culture as well. I was talking to a friend of mine last night who remembered going to a party in a freshman dorm at Harvard. So this is just a normal dorm where they had hired a lacrosse player to stand at the door with a list of who was allowed in to this dorm. And he explained to my friend that a party at Harvard isn't cool unless it's exclusive, which kind of made us both gag a little bit. And, you know, it's hard to know, does that derive from the culture that really prizes these off-campus clubs, or does that culture of exclusivity have... Is that just pervasive throughout the whole campus, and the clubs are just a symptom and not a source? And so I think it's absolutely true that, you know, it doesn't surprise me that a school that does a good job of being inclusive and promoting collaboration is going to see that manifest in its private clubs.
All right. Let's go actually talk to a Harvard graduate, Rachel in Brooklyn. Welcome to WNYC.
Hey there. Thanks for taking my call. Yes, I went to Harvard. I was not a member of any of the final clubs. I wasn't a single co-ed club. And I think what it certainly shocked me at the age of 18, having grown up in New York City, was that every single party at Harvard had a list, like your guest is saying. you know, and if you're an attractive 18-year-old girl, you realize very quickly that the way that you dress and the way that you present yourself is going to give you access into this club and into this party. Now, if you're an 18-year-old boy, you're not allowed in. It's no question. And you basically have to go through this process when you're 19 to see whether you can get into the club. And you spend a year watching all your female peers sort of be pressured into dressing and acting a certain way towards the members of this club so that they're given access to the parties, to the nightlife. Now, beyond that, I mean, let's just put aside the massive moral issue of, you know, sexual harassment and putting young women in a position where they have to be kind of unconditionally polite and unconditionally attractive to gain access to the sphere at the university. There's also just the long-term effects of this, which is that the men in these clubs for the rest of their lives have access to this network that is very, like, the most privileged network in the world, right? And so for the rest of their lives, they get to call on anybody that they knew at any time or any alumni, and they spend their entire punch process, which is the pledging process of the final clubs at Harvard, going and meeting these alumni and having these events at these alumni's incredible homes all over New England. And so it's for the rest of their lives they're instilled in this network that they get to use forever that women just don't have. And women are already at a disadvantage, you know, because they're women in the workforce. So to kind of compound that with this incredible exclusive context of networking is just so blatantly unfair and ridiculous. And as a student, as an alumni there, I am thrilled to see that they're trying to do away with this. And, you know, I don't think they need to do away with the whole thing. They absolutely have to make it co-ed. You know, I think making it co-ed would really resolve a lot of these glaring problems that I think, my last comment is just serve as a cross-section of what's going on in most parts of the world and most upper echelons of society.
Yeah, thank you, Rachel, for the call. Alexandra, the elitism question that Rachel brings up is very important as well. It's not just about gender exclusivity or potential, you know, sexual danger. It's about elitism. It's about connections, right?
Absolutely. And I think that what I have heard, and again, I, you know, did not go to Harvard, and I know that, you know, Rachel and others have more insight into this. But
alas,
my understanding is that a lot of these clubs are, alumni of fancy New England prep school, you know, tapping each other and just rather than, you know, meeting new people and experiencing new things, the clubs are basically able to replicate the environment, you know, the exclusive and privileged environment that many of the members grew up in. I'm sure there are exceptions to that, but it's absolutely true that when we're talking about private clubs, it's not just about sex, it's about class and often about race as well.
Indeed. One last caller, Lloyd from Manhattan, quickly. Welcome, Lloyd.
Hi. This is Lloyd.
Yes.
I'm a graduate of Williams College. Williams banned fraternities in 1963. So I'm a member of the class of 69. At the time that I went to Williams, and I went there because they had banned fraternities, Williams was one of the top five liberal arts colleges in the country. For the last 25 years, Williams has been rated either the first or the second best liberal arts college in the country. Forbes rated it the number one college or university in the United States, above Harvard or Yale. And all of that has happened since Williams banned fraternities. At the time that they banned fraternities, fraternities were engines for discrimination and exclusion, and the college has not just thrived, but just luxuriated under banning fraternities. There's nothing particularly radical about what Harvard is considering doing. It's been done before, it's been done more than 50 years before, and it's been done very successfully.
Indeed. Thank you, Lloyd, for the call. Now, that brings up another question. Does banning fraternities maybe have a potentially good effect on academic performance? Alexander, what do you think?
That's interesting. I could imagine that that is true. I could imagine that you know, particularly for alcohol, for fraternities that really center on alcohol and, you know, excessive drinking, that some space away from that culture could be helpful for some students. But, you know, and I think that this goes to some of the earlier comments, I do think that community is important for students, for their overall experience at the university and for their academic performance. College is really tough. You know, I think we forget that sometimes, that, you know, often you're young, you're away from home for the first time. There are very high rates of depression amongst college students. And I think that a strong community can be an important buoy during that hard time. You know, I think can help students excel. So, you know, I think, again, this just goes to the point that whether, you know, if schools are moving to prohibit certain forms of social communities, they also need to be making an active effort to promote alternatives and to create a space for students to find each other and feel connected.
Alexander, while I have you here, I have to ask you about the recent reports concerning Education Secretary Betsy DeVos and her new focus on campus sexual assault. You had been invited to meet with her, along with members of so-called men's rights groups who have regularly ridiculed rape accusers. Can you tell us why you were later disinvited from meeting with the secretary?
Sure. So I'm sort of straddling two organizational roles here. So I did attend the meeting last week along with my colleagues from the National Women's Law Center. But before I was an adult at this job, and when I was a student organizer, I worked with a group called Know Your Nine. And Know Your Nine, which still exists and is run by awesome youth leaders, had been originally invited to the meeting with Secretary DeVos to talk about the importance of civil rights enforcement for survivors. But after my co-founder Dana and I published a critical op-ed in the Washington Post about the importance of Title IX and transparency, the group was disinvited. The department just went radio silent, and, you know, we don't have any confirmation that it was because of the op-ed, but it is mighty suspicious.
Well, let me pause for a moment just to give station ID, WNYC-FM-HD, NAM New York, WNJT-FM 88.1 Trenton, WNJP 88.5 Sussex, WNJY 89.3 Netcong, and WNJO 90.3 Toms River. We're going to have to leave it there for today. My guest has been civil rights attorney Alexandra Brodsky, a civil rights attorney who is a Skadden Fellow at the National Women's Law Center and the co-founder of the organization Know Your Nine. Alexandra, thanks for joining me. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.